to recap the main results of last time, so we had some kind of scalar field, which may or may not be a fundamental scalar, but just some order parameter, phi, potential via phi. And we found that the equations of motion are phi double dot, 3h phi dot, plus v prime of phi is equal to 0, and h squared, which is a dot over a squared, is equal to 8 pi, 3 and Planck squared, 1 half, phi dot squared, plus v of phi. And this thing has an equation of state. Rho is 1 half, phi dot squared, plus v of phi, and pressure is equal to 1 half phi dot squared minus v of phi. So in order to get a negative pressure, p less than minus 1/3 rho, we have to have 1 half phi dot squared to be much, much less than v of phi. That is, the field is slowly rolling and the energy density and pressure are dominated by potential, which gives us a negative pressure. And in the slow roll limit, we are looking for a solution that has this particular form where the energy density is dominated by the potential and the equation of motion for the field is friction dominated, that the drag from the Hubble expansion is dominating over the phi double dot term. And in this case, we can write this parameter epsilon, which is Planck squared 16 pi v prime of phi over v of phi squared. This is important because we can write pressure is equal to rho times 2/3 epsilon minus 1. And we have that inflation, that is, p less than minus 1/3 rho happens when this parameter epsilon phi is less than 1. And this, remember, we've defined epsilon in terms of m Planck squared over 4 phi h prime of phi over h phi squared. If you write epsilon this way, this relation is exact even when you're not in slow roll. But in the limit that this approximation up here, the slow roll approximation is good, then you have epsilon to be written in directly in terms of potential, which is a much more convenient form when you're doing calculations. Okay? But one of your homework problems was to show that for that this relation and this relation are essentially exact. They don't depend on the assumption of slow roll, that you can derive those from the full equation of motion. Yeah. Okay. And the last thing we did was derive an expression for the number of e-folds where xp the integral h dt is defined to be e to the number of e-folds, where n we derived in terms of m Planck integral d phi over square root. This equation of state parameter epsilon also determines how quickly you accumulate E folds of expansion. Okay. This little parameter pops up in all sorts of places in inflation, and one place is here. So this is this M of phi is usually the measure the figure of merit for how much inflation we have. So how much inflation do we need? How long does this inflationary period need to go on in order to solve the horizon and flatness problems? So in general, what I have, so let's just take a qualitative picture of what an inflationary potential looks like. Suppose we have some sort of spontaneous symmetry breaking potential. What happens is, up near the top here, where V prime of phi is small and the field is slowly rolling, this is the region of the potential where we're going to have inflation. Field is going to roll down to some field value that I'll call phi end, where this is defined by epsilon is equal to 1, right? So as long as the parameter is smaller than 1 up in this region, right? So epsilon is less than 1 here. And this ending field value, phi sub e, is defined to be the point where as this potential steepens and steepens, epsilon finally goes through 1 and inflation stops. So now we have exactly what we wanted, which was an early period of accelerated expansion that evolves dynamically toward a period of not accelerated expansion, right? But remember, since the universe is expanding quasi-exponentially, all the matter and radiation, whatever was in it before, is all exponentially diluted. So that what we end up with when we hit that field value phi is equal to phi end, if we inflate enough, is we have a big, empty, zero entropy universe. It's basically, I have nothing but vacuum left. I have a universe with nothing in it and a temperature of absolute zero, which does not make for a hot Big Bang. So I need to repopulate the universe with radiation. Okay, so what I want to do is make a transition from a vacuum-dominated to a radiation-dominated universe. The way I do that is the field rolls down here and starts to oscillate about its minimum. So basically what I have is like a big Bose-Einstein condensate. I have this coherent scalar field that's oscillating around the bottom of the potential. And somehow I'm going to couple that field to my other degrees of freedom in my theory. And that big Bose-Einstein condensate that I have oscillating around the bottom of the potential is going to either very gradually or very quickly, depending on what kind of model I have, is going to decay into other degrees of freedom. And it's that decay of this vacuum-like object, it's the decay of this inflaton field that repopulates the universe with radiation, and we get into a nice radiation-dominated hot Big Bang. So the initial conditions, essentially, for the Big Bang are set by the inflaton decay during this period of reheating. And I'm not going to talk in any kind of, you could give a whole series of lectures on the intricacies of reheating. It's a very interesting subject. I'm just going to treat it very qualitatively and dimensionally. All I want to know is, what are the properties of this reheating? How can I use this to estimate how much inflation I need? Okay? And the argument I'm going to use to sort of estimate how many E-folds of inflation I need is a thermodynamic one. Okay? So I'm going to assert this without proof. The entropy of our current horizon in the universe today is about 10 to the 88th. Now, Joao kind of mentioned this very in passing yesterday. It probably didn't make much of an impression. But basically, all of the entropy in our current horizon volume is contained in the CMB photons. So radiation degrees of freedom are where all the entropy in the world lives. But basically, the entropy of a cosmological volume, we can estimate it as the volume we're considering, right, the physical size of the space. So this would be our horizon volume, times the temperature of the photons in that volume, Q. Now, I'm not deriving this, but you can see dimensionally this is correct. This gives us a nice dimensionless number, and it's probably, hopefully it will be believable to you that this is really a measure of entropy at a given cosmological volume. And so, and this is essentially the temperature of the photons, because the matter in the universe is decoupled from the radiation, right? We don't, the temperature of, say, full dark matter is a lot lower. But, so this would be today, this would be our horizon volume times the CMB temperature cubed, gives you a number about 10 to the 8. Okay? So that tells us how much radiation, essentially, we need to create at the end of inflation. We need to create enough entropy so that we have 10 to the 88 entropy today. We need to create at least this much entropy at the end of inflation. Because unless it's a truism of cosmological evolution, that unless you actually have a particle decaying, a massive particle decaying into radiation, the entropy in a given co-moving volume is a conserved quantity. Right? So in the absence of any particle decays, you do not create or destroy any entropy. The expansion of the universe is just preserves it. So all of the entropy that we have in our horizon today has to have been created by the particle decay at the end of inflation. These are just words, I know, but the numerology here is, in order to solve the horizon problem, essentially, in order to make the universe as big as it is today, the number I have to match is I have to create entropy of about 10 to the 88. Okay, so suppose during inflation, I have some energy density rho, which is the finite, and I'm just going to call this some, dimensionally this is going to be some energy scale to the fourth power. And the horizon size is, the horizon is just given by 1 over the Hubble parameter during inflation, which if we look up here, this is going to be of order the potential divided by the Planck mass squared, or m Planck over lambda squared, right? Where that number just comes from the Friedman equation here, where I have h squared is v of phi over m Planck squared, right? So h inverse goes like m Planck over the energy density squared. So now, during inflation, I take a little patch about the size of my horizon. The universe is expanding exponentially. So a co-moving scale that starts out as my horizon size here is going to be inflated to a volume of V goes as, so if I start out at the beginning of inflation with a volume that looks like the cube of my horizon size, after n e folds of inflation, that volume is going to be increased in size to e to the 3n of its original volume. Which is e to the 3n m Planck cubed over lambda to the 6. So now, at the end of inflation, what I have is a really exponentially large patch of space that started out being my horizon size during inflation. Now it's really huge. It's got zero temperature, and it's filled with an oscillating field with energy density about equal to this, right? So this is going to be a good estimate of the energy density at the end of inflation as well as the beginning. I mean, it's probably going to be a little lower because of expansion, but we're doing order of magnitude estimate here. So now, that thing is going to decay into radiation. So phi goes to some sort of relativistic degree of freedom. And we can estimate the temperature that the radiation is going to be created. So the scalar field decays completely into radiation. And just dimensionally, we know that the temperature of that radiation is going to be of order the energy scale the inflation in the first place, right? So this is sort of an instantaneous reheating approximation. We're going to assume that all the energy of the inflaton goes straight into radiation with perfect efficiency. In the real world, the efficiency will be lower, but you know those are order unity factors out front.
Why does it have to be radiation, not so
many? Well, first of all, we know that the universe is radiation dominated at early times. Second of all, if it decays to matter, it's not creating any entropy. All the entropy lives in the radiation.
But can't there be another phase transition between matter and radiation?
There could be, yeah. But so what? Then it just that adds the order unity factor out in front of that. We end up with radiation at the end of the day. I don't care how. So we could go through a matter-dominated phase. And in general, in fact, if you work it out, that oscillating scalar at the bottom actually typically gives you a matter-dominated expansion briefly before it decays. So you go from inflation to matter domination, which is the oscillating scalar field. The oscillating scalar field decays at relativistic degrees of freedom. You end up with a radiation-dominated universe. And that is one of the things that adds order unity factors up front of that number. I'm just assuming that happens rapidly. So now, the entropy in this volume here is given by the volume times the temperature cubed is e to the 3 times the number of e folds, m Planck cubed over lambda to the 6th times t cubed. And this has to be greater than or equal to 10 to the 88. And so factoring that in, we have e to the 3n m Planck over lambda cubed, putting in that estimate for the reheat temperature. And that means that n has to be greater than or equal to 68 plus log of lambda over the Planck scale. And typically in inflation models, lambda is around the gut scale, about 10 to the minus 4 in Planck, which gives us n has to be greater than or equal to about 60. So this is, in a very simple way, there's more sophisticated ways to do this calculation, but this is a sort of the simplest estimate where this famous figure of you need about 60 e folds of inflation to solve the horizon and Clapham's problems. Basically, in order to create enough entropy in the universe to fill our current horizon volume, you have to have about that much inflation. You're looking confused, bro.
Are you good? Yeah, can you do that step? How do you get 68?
Log of 10 to the 88. Yeah, right. So in order to solve for n in this inequality, you have to take the logarithm of it, and it comes out to about 68. So in most inflation models, you have way, way more than 60 e folds of inflation. Yes?
At the point we haven't talked about back reaction on the effects like coming from semi-classical gravity, which is sort of a calculation. Is there any chance this bumps into the picture?
Back reaction of what?
Like space-time. Because space-time is curved and it's inflating or it's changing shape. Anyway, uh-huh. You're going to be generating and absorbing particles as well, right? You're going to be changing part of the quantum.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, right. And, well, this gets into the question of perturbations in inflation, which is what we're going to go through it with amazing rapidity during the last hour of the talk. But back reaction of perturbations in the inflaton, for example, is a subject where there's a large literature on it, and it's very complicated, and nobody really understands it very well. There's a lot of controversy about exactly what effect these back reactions or perturbations and stuff have on that expansion. In this case, you don't really have to worry about it. I mean, it's just a straightforward. You're doing basically doing quantum field theory in a curved background, but you're not trying to calculate how that couples to the background itself, right? But as long as perturbations are small, we can get away with it. So we need about 60 e-folds of inflation to do the trick. And most inflation models, you can inflate for way, way, way more than 60 e-folds of inflation. Typically, a typical inflation model will inflate for 10,000 e-folds if you want it to. So that this is not a real strict, horrible limit to meet. Most inflation models will meet this limit and hit a total overkill. But this is the minimum amount that you need. And doing a bit more sophisticated calculation, tells you that unless you have a lot of entropy production later on in the universe, that the total number of e-folds of inflation has to be greater than something that goes between about 46 and 60, depending on how, depending on the details of how this reheating process takes place. In particular, if the universe reheats to a very low temperature, you can get away with fewer e-folds of inflation than if it reheats to a high temperature. Okay, so let's look at this entire thing in the context of a particular potential, because we've been doing lots and lots of formalism and not many examples. So I want to go through, in the case of a particular choice of potential, how the math works out and what field values and stuff like that are for inflation. So let's take as an example V of phi is equal to lambda phi to the fourth, which is, unfortunately, this model is now ruled out by the WMAP data, but it still makes a nice clean example. But this is observationally has been killed by the most recent version of WMAP. So the slow roll equation of motion for this potential. So I'm just going to take this thing right here is phi dot is equal to minus v prime of phi over 3h. And if I take h as being given by this slow roll approximation, right? So the phi dot term disappears and h is just proportional, h squared is just proportional to the potential. Then I have this is equal to minus square root of un Planck squared or 24 pi v prime of phi over square root of v. So the thing about the slow roll approximation that makes life easy is that we have phi dot and h, and all of our quantities are essentially all just functions of the field phi. So now, let's just take a look at, let's diagram this potential, right? So we have a lambda phi to the fourth model, something like that. And this is, we've been drawing the inflationary potential as something like that, which has a big flat plateau on it and you're rolling off the top of the hill. There's another way to achieve this condition of epsilon less than 1, which is that, remember that epsilon, the parameter that we have to make small in order for inflation to happen, looks like v prime over v squared, right? So in a potential like this, where I have lambda phi to the fourth, v prime increases more slowly than v does, right? So v prime is proportional to phi cubed, right? So if I want to make v prime over v small, what I can do is if I make the field big enough, if I push it far enough out on the potential because this thing increases, it has one less power of phi in it, as I go further and further up the potential, that parameter is going to get smaller and smaller, and if I go up far enough, I'm going to have epsilon less than 1, and I'm going to have inflationary expansion. So another way to do it is to just take any regular potential, m squared, phi squared, or any monomial like this, and push the field far enough out, because v prime is always going to increase more slowly than v. And so, what's going to happen here is that in this region, I'm going to have epsilon less than 1. But out here, if I make the field big enough, I'm going to have epsilon greater than 1. And the dividing line between the two is this field value I'm going to call phi n. Okay? So up here I will be inflating, and down here I will be reheating. Yeah. Oh, no, sorry. Okay. So inflation ends when epsilon is m plunk squared over 16 pi v prime of phi v of phi squared is equal to 1. And it is not hard to show that this for a lambda phi 4 potential over phi is just m plunk over phi squared, 1 over pi. So that means that this field value, phi n, is just given by m plunk over the square root of pi. So that the field has to be pushed out to a field value of order of the Planck scale in order for inflation to happen. Now, whether or not you think that's reasonable in the context of an effective field theory is going to matter. Okay? But this is a fairly typical thing in inflation models, is that you have to have field values of order the Planck scale in order for inflation to happen. Yes?
How would you expect that it got there in the first place?
Oh, hell, I don't know. I mean, there is no explanation for that. Why is the field that far up the potential? It just has to be. So people will do all sorts of, like, strange gyrations with an anthropic principle and stuff to justify this sort of thing. But the reality is that, you know, nobody understands how inflation starts. Okay? Remember, we need to have 60 E folds of inflation in order to solve the horizon and flatness problems. It turns out also that the observable perturbations that we can see, say, in the CMB and stuff, are all generated during the last 60 E folds of inflation. We'll talk about this in a minute. But so basically, all we have observational access to is the last 60 E folds of this expansion. Now, inflation can go on for 10,000 E folds. We have no way of observing what was happening in those 10,000 E folds. In particular, we have no observational access to the initial conditions. Whatever started inflation, whatever the universe was like at the beginning of inflation, is redshifted exponentially to incredibly large scales, and we can no longer have any kind of observational access to it. Which means that we have a nice model for the end of inflation, and we have no model for the beginning of inflation. And in particular, any model we would come up with at the beginning of inflation is pretty much in principle untestable, which is a bummer. But there you have it. So I'm not going to talk about initial conditions at all. I'm just going to say by some magic fairy dust, the field ends up here, and that's it, right? Okay, so we are inflating. That is, epsilon is less than 1 for any field value phi greater than this field value phi e, which is about the Planck mass. So now I want to say, okay, how far up does the field have to be in order to give me at least 60 e folds of inflation? So I'm not going to crash down here. I'm just going to use lots of blackboard space. In order to figure that out, I need to calculate the number of E folds. And I'm going to define this parameter n. Remember, I left the limits off the integral on n deliberately, because we're going to define the number of e-folds in a funny way. We're actually going to define it as the number of e-folds remaining in inflation, right? So n is equal to 0 at phi is equal to phi n, and gets bigger as we go backward in time. Because once again, all we care about is the last 60 e-folds. We don't know how or where inflation began, but we're just talking about the last little bit. So we're going to define the number of e-folds accordingly. So I'm going to take n is equal to 2 times the square root of pi over m Planck, integral from the end of inflation back to whatever my field value is. So this is now a function of phi. So I start here and integrate up. D phi prime over square root of epsilon phi prime. And this integral comes out to which, if you plug in phi, is equal to phi end, n is equal to 0, and n gets bigger as phi gets bigger as you go backward in time. So the field value, n e-fold prior to the end of inflation, is equal to m Planck times n plus 1 over pi. So in order to have 60 e-folds before the end of inflation is about 4.4 m Planck. Now notice that the field is transplanckian, right? The field value is bigger than the Planck scale, which you might think gives you problems with quantum gravity. But because of the fact that the energy density is given by lambda phi to the fourth, right? Here, the energy density is given by the potential. Typically, in these models, lambda is a lot smaller than 1. And we'll come up with an estimate of lambda in a minute. That the energy density, in fact, is much, much less than the Planck scale. So that you have a universe that is, the temperature, the energy density of the universe is much below the Planck mass, and you don't really have to worry directly about quantum gravity. All right, so despite the fact that it looks like we're going to be in a regime where we have to care about quantum gravitational effects, it's not so because of the fact that the energy density is still much less than m Planck before. There's a lot of argument in the literature as to whether or not field values like this are self-consistent in the context of effective field theory, for reasons I won't get into. But strictly from the point of view of do we need to care about quantum gravitational effects directly, the answer is no, we do not.
Yeah. Can we condensate from particles much less than Planck scale, for example?
Because otherwise you won't get a field value. Are you saying that if it's a condensate?
It's condensate of fields that have masses less than, or magnitude less than Planck scale. And this condensate like acts like effectively in Planck.
Are you asking, could it be so?
Yeah.
It's difficult to come up with a self-consistent effective field theory for which you can have field values like this. And in particular, there's a paper, look up a paper by David Light in 1996. It's a PRL, where he discusses the difficulties of formulating effective field theories with these kind of transplanting field effects. And this is something that, like I said, there's a lot of argument about it, whether or not you can really do this properly in effective field theory. But just strictly from the standpoint of just classically putting together a potential and going to town with it, you can't. You know, there's no particular inconsistency. Like I said, the energy density is what you really care about to the lowest order as to whether or not you need to do quantum gravity. But how you actually produce an inflation model like this is another matter. Typically what happens when you have inflaton potentials that look like this, Right up here, the field value is very small during inflation, so you wouldn't think you'd have this kind of problem. But you find out that the width of the potential, this width that you would call mu, has to be generically of order of the Planck scale, unless you have special symmetries in the problem. So this particular issue, these field values that look like on Planck, are not confined to a lambda phi 4 or an m squared phi squared potential. They're pretty much generic in virtually any inflation model that you would want to consider. And you have to really go through some gyrations to make the width of that potential small. Okay. So this is the basic background dynamics. We've done what it is that we need to do to solve the horizon and flatness problems. We've actually come up with a particular scalar field model that gives us sufficient inflation, creates enough entropy, does everything that we need to do. I mean, obviously, I haven't talked about the particular couplings and the details for heating and all that kind of stuff, but all the numbers work out. It's possible to do to get a scalar field, a simple scalar field model that will cause enough accelerated expansion to solve the horizon and flatness problems. So, to change subject now, and what I'm going to devote the rest of my time to, I could devote a whole lot more than just the rest of this lecture to this subject. It's very interesting, and it's very involved as well, so we're just going to sort of skim over the surface of it, is the generation of perturbations. So inflation, now this background picture, we have a homogeneous scalar field, it does all this cool stuff for us, but the other thing that you get for free in inflation is that perturbations in the scalar field, perturbations in the inflaton, actually can generate the initial conditions for structure formation, the stuff that Joao was talking about yesterday, those little 10 to the minus 5 fluctuations in the CMB, can also be explained within the context of this kind of a model. And the way that happens is through the generation of perturbations. And the key thing here is, the key point, is that co-moving scales during inflation increase relative to the horizon stops. This is how we solve the horizon problem, right? We have d e log a of some scale d divided by d horizon is greater than 0. So if I take something that is co-moving with the expansion, some length scale, it starts out small and it gets big. And in particular, things that start out smaller than the horizon size of my universe get bigger than the horizon size of my universe exponentially rapidly. Right? So if I start out, in particular, with some little wave, be it a photon or anything, right? Any wave-like mode, what happens very quickly in inflation is that the wavelength of that mode is stretched to larger than my horizon size. Right? So in particular, if I have some with wavelength lambda, I start out with lambda in the ultraviolet, and I end up with lambda in the infrared, where this thing is actually bigger than the horizon size of my universe. And that characteristic of inflationary spacetimes is what allows us to generate initial conditions for structure formation. We start out with tiny little quantum modes in the ultraviolet limit, where we know how to quantize the field. But those things very rapidly get stretched to extremely large scales, where, in fact, the curvature of the universe ends up being the dominant thing in the equation of motion for the mode. And then we have, and those things turn into classical perturbations. in my background.
All the physical skills.
What about which physical skills?
I mean, there is someone, a factor, uh-huh. Difference between co-moving and physical skills.
By co-moving here, I mean something that is co-moving with the expansion, so lambda is increasing with A. Okay, so this wavelength will be constant in co-moving units, but in physical units will be proportional to the scale factor. Does that clarify?
Yeah.
Sorry, that's a piece of jargon that probably is a little confusing. Thank you. So, if I had another hour and a half lecture, we could go into the very beautiful subject of quantizing these fields in the curved spacetime in its full glory, and it's really a cool calculation. I will leave photocopies of my notes on this subject will be available so that you guys, anybody who's interested in it, can read them. But unfortunately, we won't have time to go through it. But what I will do is qualitatively sketch out how the solution works. So what we're going to consider is some free scalar field that I'm going to call script phi. Now, this is not the inflaton, or it could be the inflaton. So it could be a gravity wave mode. It is not hard to show that if you do perturbation about the background, then you have tensor perturbations, and the equation of motion for those tensor perturbations is that of free scalar field. Right, so this could be a gravity wave mode that's described by this field. Or this could be an inflaton perturbation. That is, phi is equal to some background field plus some perturbation. These are going to give you primordial gravitational waves. These are going to give you primordial density perturbations. The difference between the two is that this is simply a free scalar field. I mean, it just goes off. It's completely decoupled from the rest of the background expansion to linear order. This thing, on the other hand, if I have V of phi, you know, so if I have a potential that looks something like this, if I perturb my field a little bit, if I introduce a perturbation in the inflaton, that introduces a perturbation in the energy density driving the expansion. And that causes perturbations in the density of the universe at late times. So inflaton perturbations are special because the inflaton is what's dominating the energy density of the universe during inflation. So if I perturb that thing, I'm actually directly, the inflaton has coupled first order the curvature of the space-time. Inflaton couples curvature at linear order. Which implies density perturbations. This first order coupling to the curvature also introduces a lot of complications into the calculation because you have to not only quantize this free scalar field, and what we're going to be talking about is field quantization now, through quantum mechanics in this background, but in the case of the inflaton, because it couples to the curvature at linear order, you must quantize a combination of the field and the curvature in a particular way. And there's a large literature on this subject. We're not going to get into the details of it at all. But just know that these inflaton perturbations are special, and then these are the things that create the density perturbations in the universe. But what I'm going to do is just sketch out this process for an arbitrary free scalar. I'm not going to specify what it is. This will work for inflaton perturbations as long as you are clever about it. So for a free scalar field, that is, and now this thing is not going to be dominating the energy density of the universe. So the scalar field responsible for inflation is going to be causing this accelerated expansion. We're going to be talking about some other field living in the space-time that is not coupled that's only going to feel the expansion. The Hubble constant isn't going to feel field value at all. So we have 1 over square root of minus g, partial nu, g mu nu, square root of minus g, partial mu, phi is equal to 0. This is our equation of motion. So g is determined by the inflaton, the inflationary expansion, and this field is just along for the ride. This gives us an equation of motion to a prime over a, phi prime minus box square root phi is equal to 0, where phi prime is d phi with respect to conformal time tau. Okay. And we will do the usual Fourier expansion of this for a quantum field theory, phi of tau and x is dq k phi 3 halves phi sub k of tau times ak cat e to the I k dot x plus phi k star tau base k hat dagger e to the minus I k dot x. These are creation and annihilation operators, not scale factor. Okay. There's a bit of a notational collision here between our A's, but that's all right. And here, remember that since we have a metric, ds squared, k squared root of tau, d tau squared minus dx squared, I'm going to only consider a flat metric. That this is a co-moving coordinate. So this is going to be a co-moving wave number. In particular, this is equal to A times the usual physical wave number. Okay? So this is something, this is just a number. As the universe evolves, this thing doesn't change. The physical wave number is changing by, is proportional to 1 over the scale factor, right? But so this thing actually acts as a label, a phase space label on the field mode in exactly the same way it does in Minkowski space. And so I have phi double prime plus 2 a prime over a phi prime plus k squared phi is equal to 0. So these Fourier modes, these functions of time, phi sub k, obey this equation of motion. And by a field redefinition, I can make this, so this, if not for this expansion piece, this would just be a Klein-Gordon equation and we would quantize the field in the way we normally do, right? But we have this funny friction term in the middle. So how are we going to write this down in a way that we can quantize? The trick is, to introduce a field redefinition, I'm going to define a new mode function. Uk of tau is defined to be A of tau times 5k of tau. And from that equation of motion, it's trivial to show that I have an equation of motion for the u, k squared minus a double prime of tau over a of tau, u sub k is equal to 0. This is a Klein-Gordon equation in an expanding space. And I want to quantize this field. But it's easy to just read off from this equation what the qualitative behavior of this mode function is going to be. Okay? So there are two limits. The thing is going to start out at short wavelengths. All right, so I'm going to have some mode, and it's going to be in the ultraviolet limit. I'm going to have some, you know, extremely short wavelength quantum fluctuation. And quantitatively, in this equation, it takes place when, so in the ultraviolet limit, we're going to be dominated by our momentum term k here, and the expansion term isn't going to matter. Okay, so if the wavelength of my mode is much, much less than the horizon size, basically I'm not going to see the expansion. I'm just going to see something that looks like a regular Klein-Gordon equation. Right? And in that case, I know what the solution to this thing is. I have u sub k is equal to k sub k e to the minus I k tau plus b sub k e to the plus I k tau. Right? Notice that this looks like a standard Minkowski wave function, except that k is a co-moving wave number. And this is a conformal time. Right? So these are not your standard, this is the usual quantities that you would get when you quantize a field in Minkowski space. These are conformal quantities. So this is a Minkowski wave function only in the k goes to infinity limit. Only in the ultraviolet limit does this actually match Minkowski space. At any finite wave number, at any finite wavelength, this is only quasi-Minkowski. But nonetheless, I mean, if we work in the ultraviolet limit, if we're far enough in the ultraviolet limit, we can quantize this field in exactly the way we would quantize a field in Minkowski space. Right? We know how quantum field theory works in the ultraviolet, even in an expanding universe, right? Which is a good thing, because otherwise quantum field theory would be impossible in the laboratory, because we live in an accelerating universe now, right? So just in the same way that we can approximate things at the LHC as being Minkowski space quantum fields, we can do the same thing here. Now the long wavelength limit is where things get interesting. We have that uk double prime plus or minus a double prime over a, u sub k is equal to 0. Oops. So this is in the limit where k squared is much, much less than a double prime over a. In this case, we have something that looks like A U double prime is equal to A double prime U, right? That means that we have a solution for U that is not oscillatory at all. This mode function just becomes proportional to the scale factor at long wavelength. And that means that our field coefficient phi is U sub k over A, just goes to a constant. So we create some quantum field of very short wavelength where it acts like a Minkowski wave function. And then as this thing gets stretched along wavelength, what happens is when it's much, much bigger than the horizon size, it just goes to a constant value. It ceases to evolve at all. And this is the process that you will see referred to in the literature a lot as mode freezing. And it's a process very much akin to Hawking radiation. So we have these little quantum modes, and when they get stretched outside the horizon, they get to a constant non-zero value. And this is how we generate density perturbations. In order to calculate the amplitude, how big this thing is when it's outside the horizon, what we need to do is find these integration constants at short wavelength, right? If we know, if we can find boundary conditions that tell us what A sub k and B sub k are, then the evolution of the mode is completely specified by short wavelength behavior, and all we have to do is follow it out to long wavelengths, and we can calculate the normalization of this thing when it's outside the horizon. Is that clear? Yes?
Is that the only solution?
It's the only solution we care about. This is a second order differential equation, so there is more than one. But this will end up being the dominant solution. There's also a decaying mode. Right? So there's a second solution to this differential equation where u sub k goes as 1 over a power of a, and those become subdominant at long wavelengths. They can, at times, be important under particular circumstances. So there are circumstances in which you have to care about the decaying mode in order to correctly calculate this perturbation spectrum. But that's a technical detail that we won't be worried about. But it's a good question. I have actually been writing a lot of papers the past year or two on exactly that subject. So it's near and dear to my heart. Okay. So in order to calculate the amplitude of this thing, all we need to do is find our integration constants in the ultraviolet limit. And we do that through quantization. Well, there are two processes. We have two constants, right? So let me back up a little bit. So determining A and B is the entire name of the game here. And one boundary condition we have is the canonical quantization condition, right? Sure.
You're saying that these wavelengths get out of the horizon, mm-hmm. and then they get frozen. Mm-hmm. At a certain point, you get the gain.
Right, but after inflation, when you get to decelerating expansion, these things fall back into the horizon and then form classical perturbations, and that's where you get structure formation. Right.
This is what we
exactly.
see
them. Right.
They get back again.
Precisely, yeah. Right. So that these things, they're way bigger than the horizon during inflation, but inflation ends, the horizon size starts to grow in co-moving units again because the expansion of the universe is decelerating, they fall back into the horizon and they behave as classical perturbations, and this is where we get galaxy formation and all this stuff, inflation frame models. Okay? So this is how we're generating these initial perturbations. But you notice, for example, in the Kobe map, right? So here's this map of the sky and you have all these fluctuations, right? So you have these big perturbations. The horizon size at the time these photons were emitted was about 1 degree. So when you're looking at these CMB maps and the very large scale perturbations up around the quadrupole, the low L modes that, on the left over here, so in that plot that Chuao showed, all this stuff over here is larger than a degree. everything to the left of that first big bump, right, is super horizon size at the time those photons were emitted. All of these fluctuations that you're seeing at L less than about 100 or so in the CMB are bigger than the horizon size at the time the CMB was formed. They are exactly these super horizon modes that we're talking about in the inflationary calculation. So the boundary conditions we have on this wave function are, number one, quantization. And number two, vacuum selection. Okay. Let's do quantization first, and I will talk about the issue of vacuum selection, because that's also a very there's a lot of very cool recent literature on the subject. Quantization I can define a canonical momentum. And it turns out that the nice way to define this is my canonical momentum pi, which is a function of conformal time and co-moving coordinate, is delta L delta partial with respect to conformal time of the field. This turns out to be the right way to define the canonical momentum in a curved space-time. And this is equal to a squared times partial, okay? Partial. So that there's an extra factor of a squared in the canonical momentum that you have to carry around with you. And when written in this way, the canonical quantization condition, or the commutation relation, is phi of tau x pi of tau prime x prime evaluated at equal times, except these are now conformal times. So this looks like an equal time commutator, except we're doing things in terms of the conformal instead of the coordinate time, is I del cubed x minus x prime. So this looks exactly like a regular canonical commutator, except it's all in co-moving coordinates and conformal time. And as the last exercise I'm going to assign, this canonical commutation relation results in the condition that ak squared minus bk squared has to equal 1 in the short wavelength limit. Okay? And so your last exercise is to actually go through this with the full field definition in terms of those operators and work out the canonical commutation relation and show that this is true. And I'll provide a solution to that in the photocopy of the notes that I leave behind, because it's a few pages. Let's put it that way. OK, so quantization tells us that we have this relationship between these two integration constants of short wavelength. And we need a second condition on these things in order to fully determine the wave function. And that brings us to the issue of vacuum selection. What we want to have, yes?
So this is given that the commutation relation between AK and AK that are equal to
It's the usual commutation relation between canonical, between creation and annihilation operator, exactly. And then you go through, and basically this exercise looks like doing the usual canonical commutation relation, except there are factors of scale factor and its derivatives floating around all over the place. All right, but you end up at the end of the day with something that is exactly what you would expect. Right. Vacuum selection means that we want the thing in phi. I just erased my phi here, sorry, I should have kept that. Remember, this goes like phi sub k, ak hat, e to the I, k dot x, plus Hermitian conjugate, right? Now, in a regular quantum, in a Minkowski space quantum field theory, we know that this thing, the thing multiplying this operator, is going to be e to the minus I omega t plus I k dot x, right? So to get a standard dispersion relation out, we need to have a negative frequency, a negative here and a positive here, and that gives us our usual dispersion relation for the field. So in order to get something that looks like a properly quasi-Minkowski wave function at short wavelength, we have to say that our u sub k, this thing that's multiplying this operator over here, is going to be proportional to the e to the minus I k tau, right? So our second condition here is that in this general solution, we know that this thing has to go away, because otherwise we're going to have a positive frequency term multiplying the annihilation operator, which is bad. And so that means that b sub k is equal to 0, which means that a sub k is equal to 1. And this is what is called the bunch Davies vacuum. Okay? Now, that if that sounds like an awful lot of desperate hand-waving, it's because it is. All right? Defining exactly what the vacuum state of this field is in the ultraviolet limit is something that is not well defined. You have to just impose something onto your theory. And this is another thing, I'm emphasizing this strongly because there's also a lot of literature on this subject as to how exactly one really self-consistently defines the vacuum in the ultraviolet limit in one of these theories. And it's not completely understood. But one of the games that you can play is that if you think about this, if you look at the, you know, a universe that expands by e to the 10,000th or so, a fluctuation mode that's about the size of the CMB quadrupole today, it's about the size of our current horizon, if you follow that back to early on in inflation, that the wavelength of that mode, it turns out, if you have anything more than about 60 e folds of inflation, which you typically do, the wavelength of that mode will have been smaller than the Planck scale when you're setting this ultraviolet limit. Which means that, really, I can't take this kn goes to infinity limit self-consistently unless I actually have a full theory of quantum gravity. Because this thing is actually in the quantum gravitational regime when it's formed initially, right? So this initial condition for this mode that I'm just saying, oh yeah, well, I have a bunch of Davies vacuum, let's go for it, is ignoring the fact that we're really, the correct way to set this boundary condition is going to be when its wavelength is shorter than the Planck length, and we have to care about how quantum gravity does. So this is a problem that has no solution unless we have a theory of quantum gravity. And in particular, one can try to mock up if I put in a cutoff on this mode. If I try to do this quantization procedure when the mode is about the Planck length rather than in the infinite ultraviolet limit, I get corrections to this where, and this is goes under the name of trans-Planckian modes of inflation. In particular, I can get B of K is of the order of H over M, where this mass scale is a cutoff, M is of order, wherever my Planck scale physics comes. So this could be the string length, for example, a couple of orders of magnitude larger than the Planck scale. You can play games with it, right? So you end up with correction factors that look like the horizon size divided by your cutoff scale in these B of K's, and then these end up being imprinted on the cosmological fluctuations. So in this way, you might actually try to use these fluctuations as an observational way to look for effects of quantum gravity and the ultraviolet limit on these modes, which is pretty cool. But you really, in order to properly set this boundary condition, you care about quantum gravity, and when you do naive, just sort of dimensional estimates, you in fact do end up with corrections that end up like H over M, which in realistic inflationary models, this if you're really optimistic in every coordinate, you can make this about a 1% effect. Typically, it's a lot smaller than that. But you can push it up to about a 1% effect, and that is within the region that you might actually consider to be observable. Okay, at the end of the day, so I'm not going through any of the details, but at least I hope I've convinced you that we can fully normalize this wave function, that both of those integration constants are completely determined up to a phase, so that we know from quantization and from vacuum selection exactly what the amplitude of that quantum mode is when it leaves the horizon. It's a determined thing. There's no wiggle room. And at the end of the day, the power spectrum of these fluctuations, which I define as P of k is k cubed over 2 pi squared u sub k over a squared. And this funny normalization here comes from the idea that the two-point correlation function phi squared is d cubed k over 2 pi cubed u sub k over a squared is defined to be dk over k of the power spectrum. So all I'm doing here is taking the autocorrelation function of the field and expressing it as the power for logarithmic interval gives me this. The answer you get when you go through the exercise of quantization and normalization of that wave function is that the power spectrum as a function of k is equal to h over 2 pi squared, which is the famous result that I'm sure most of you have seen for inflation, that the amplitude of scalar field fluctuation is about equal to the Hubble constant. And so this gives you directly, for example, if this free scalar field phi is a gravitational wave perturbation, this just gives you the power spectrum of gravity waves that you are going to see in the late universe. That's it. You're done. And it turns out that this is a power law in wave number where the index of the power law is minus 2 times that equation of state parameter epsilon during inflation. So in the limit of De Sitter space, epsilon goes to 0. This thing goes to a constant. You have a completely scale invariant spectrum. But if you're a little bit off De Sitter space, if you're not quite p is equal to minus rho, that introduces a scale dependence in this. Because essentially, one mode is getting redshifted out of the horizon when the Hubble constant is here. The Hubble constant is decreasing in time, so modes that are redshifted out of the horizon later have a smaller Hubble constant, so that gives a scale dependence to this. Okay? And that dynamics of the horizon are just encoded in this equation of state parameters. Density perturbations are a little more complicated because, remember, the inflaton is coupling to the curvature. And so I will just show you the answer in the case of inflaton perturbations. Density perturbations, P of k, for which essentially looks like delta rho over rho squared. These are actually physical perturbations in the density of the late universe. So this is the thing you're seeing in the CMB and whatnot. Go like delta n, delta phi, times the square root of that autocorrelation function. Okay, So this just goes like, roughly speaking, up to factors of k, just goes like the autocorrelation function of the field. If you do the general relativistic perturbation theory correctly, perturbations in the inflaton, right? So, and there you'll see a shorthand for this a lot. It's like delta n delta phi times delta phi, right? But this is really the square root of the autocorrelation function of the field, in the same way that that is the autocorrelation function of the field. You end up with another factor of the derivative of the number of e-folds with respect to the field out in front of it, for reasons that I'm not going to explain. It's because of the coupling of the inflaton to the background expansion. And this ends up being equal to h squared over 2 pi phi dot squared. Oh, I'm sorry, this is actually that whole thing squared. So it's actually, yeah, so it looks like that. So it looks like an h over 2 pi, but then you have an extra h over phi dot factor that comes in from the coupling of this thing to the background space time in a way that is very complicated and mysterious that I'm not going to talk about. I can leave some notes on that. And this is proportional to, this is also a power law in k, which is typically written as k to the n minus 1, where n minus 1 is equal to 4 epsilon minus 2 eta, where eta is equal to, so the power law, this index here depends on epsilon, this slow roll parameter that we defined before, and it also depends on a second slow roll parameter, eta, where we had that epsilon is defined to be m plunk squared over 16 over 4 pi h prime of phi or h of phi squared. Eta is defined to be m plunk squared over 4 pi h double prime of phi. This is the second derivative now, which in the slow roll limit looks like, make sure I have my numbers right here. M plunk squared over 8 pi v double prime of phi over v of phi minus 1 half v prime of phi over v of phi squared. A lot of the times in the literature you'll see eta simply defined as v double prime over v, like the first term in this. So there's more than one convention in the literature for how you define those parameters. But with eta defined this way, the spectral index of density perturbations looks like that. And all of these things are evaluated at phi is equal to phi sub n, where n is approximately 60. Right? So the cookbook is for determining what, say, the spectrum of density perturbations and gravitational wave perturbations is I figure out when, for a given potential, I figure out when inflation ends by solving epsilon is equal to 1. Then I integrate back to find out where n is, what field value is when n is equal to 60. And then I calculate those slow roll parameters from the potential, right? Because epsilon just like looks like m plunk squared over 16 pi v prime over v squared, right? So I can calculate at phi is equal to phi sub 60, I can calculate epsilon and eta, and that tells me the spectral indices of the density perturbations. Now, in the last 5 minutes, I can at least go through we can do this for the case of lambda phi fourth, our example, which will show you what I'm talking about. So let's actually calculate the amplitudes of the tensor, the gravity waves and the scalar spectra, and the spectral indices for lambda phi fourth.
Okay. Now remember we had, just pull these couple pages here. We had that phi n of inflation is m planck over square root of pi. And we have phi 60, that is the field value 60 e fold before the end of inflation, is m planck times square root of 61 over pi, right? Or let's just call it phi n, actually. We can do it for an arbitrary number of e folds, n plus 1 over pi, okay? So this is the field value that we're going to use to evaluate all these inflationary parameters. So scalar perturbations is equal to h squared over 2 pi phi dot, and phi is equal to phi sub n. Right? So all I do to calculate the amplitude of the density perturbations in the universe is I plug phi is equal to phi sub n into that expression. It is equal to 1 over 2 pi, 8 pi over 3 m planck squared v of phi. That's h squared. Yes?
There's no square here.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is p to the 1 half. Yeah.
Okay.
We can square it at the end of the day to get the full power spectrum. But most of the time, people express these normalizations in terms of the square root of the power spectrum. And phi dot from the slow roll equation of motion, we can write this phi dot term as square root of v of phi over v prime of phi, right? This comes from phi dot is equal to minus v prime of phi over 3h. Right, that's just the slow roll equation of motion. So now if I specify the potential, I have everything I need to calculate correctly the normalization of this density perturbation amplitude is equal to, in this case, for lambda phi 4, when I go through that entire exercise, this is equal to 24 pi over 3 n plus 1 over pi times lambda 1 half. So the parameter that determines the normalization of my density perturbations is the self-coupling of the inflaton field. And I know from Kobe that normalization is of order 10 to the minus 5. And therefore, lambda has to be of order 10 to the minus 15 in order to create the proper amplitude of density perturbations in the universe. That should bug you, right? This is a highly fine-tuned theory. And radiative corrections are going to really mess with this, right? So now if I actually try to calculate one loop correction to the self-coupling from the inflaton, it's going to blow up, right? So I have a highly fine-tuned situation here in order to properly produce small enough density perturbations that I get a universe that looks like ours. This is also a serious problem with most inflationary models. They're highly fine-tuned, and this is not just peculiar to the lambda phi 4 model. This is generic. Every inflation model that you can come up with has to have some sort of highly fine-tuned dimensionless parameter in it in order to explain why the density perturbations in the universe today are as small as they are.
Excuse me. So n and lambda cannot be independently from the large spectrum.
The number of e-folds, you mean?
Yes.
Right. Well, the number of e-folds we just know is somewhere between 46 to 60, and that's an inherent uncertainty.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, this is determined from the radiation and the entropy.
Right.
We can determine it from the power spectrum itself independently.
No, you cannot. You cannot determine the number of e-folds independently. In order to figure out how many e-folds of inflation you have, You have to understand the entire thermal history of the universe starting from the end of inflation to today in detail. If you know everything that happened, if you know how much entropy was produced as a function of scale factor throughout the entire subsequent evolution of the universe, you can determine it. But that requires, that, this is why people, for example, study reheating in great detail, because the more you know about reheating, the more you can beat down this uncertainty. Because we don't know Big N to within, you know, it's 46 to 60, but that means all of our observables, the prediction of a given model is uncertain up to our uncertainty in that number N. Yes?
So my one question, how do you know that the amplitude of the thermal pressure is not there of 10 to the minus 5?
That's observational. That comes from...
Observation from the power spectrum to the observation there is then the physical process.
No, there aren't, actually. Basically, Joao will talk about this. On large scales in the CMB, so right up here, boom, 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 you get the 10 to the 9 minus 5 number from that normalization. And that, because it's super horizon size, the dominant contribution to the anisotropy of the CMB there is Sack-Wolf effect, which is a gravitational redshift. So you're actually directly observing the gravitational redshift of the light from these density perturbations. The only foreground, the only thing that shifts that around is late-time integrated Sack-Wolf effect from the cosmological constant. That's a detail that you can actually factor that out. So you can really actually directly observe the amplitude of the power spectrum.
Yes, I have a question. Why do you say that lambda is
Well, but they'd still be a lot bigger than 10 to the minus 15 if they're logarithmic, right? I mean, it begs an explanation why you have a number like 10 to the minus 15. You may come up with a theory in which it's natural to have that sort of very small dimensionless number. There are inflation models in which, you know, people would argue that that small number is pretty natural. But just naively, you would expect in a lambda 5-4 theory that this all coupling would be something of order unity, not of order 10 to the minus 15. And it would be difficult to preserve under radiative corrections if you do the math. I mean, if you're putting Planck scale cutoffs in this thing and stuff like that, it's tough. But it's a model-dependent statement, whether it's really fine-tuned or not. And we haven't really specified the full model here. We're just like, this is just the potential. So can I run 5 minutes over on my last day and be forgiven? Okay. So we calculated the scalar, the density power spectrum is given by that thing there, which requires lambda of about 10 to the minus 15. The gravity wave contribution come from, essentially, gravity waves are a much cleaner and simpler calculation. They really do act like a free scalar field like this. The power spectrum for gravity waves, 1/2 is equal to, is normalized a little bit differently, h over m Planck square root of pi. This is basically this result here with a couple of normalization factors that come in from how you identify the scalar field associated with a gravitational wave perturbation. There are normalization factors in there. Evaluated at phi is equal to phi sub n. So that means that the gravity wave divided by the scalar, usually the gravitational wave amplitude is quoted in terms of a tensor scalar ratio, which is a number that you'll see in the literature is usually called R, is equal to 16 h squared over m Planck squared pi, 4 pi squared pi dot squared over h to the fourth. When you work out all, when you plug in all the various expressions for the potential and the derivative of the potential, this is equal to m Planck over pi times v prime of phi over v of phi squared is equal to 16 times epsilon, which is a very cute result. So epsilon not only tells you the spectral index of the tensor perturbations and the equation of state during inflation and everything else you want to know, it also tells you the tensor scalar ratio. This is the ratio of power and gravity wave to the power and scalar perturbation. So since epsilon has to be a lot less than 1 for you to be inflating, you find that scalar perturbations generically dominate over gravity waves in inflation. Tensor perturbations, gravity wave perturbations, are suppressed by the same, by the equation of state factor epsilon. And in our lambda phi 4 theory, R is 16 epsilon evaluated at phi sub n is equal to 16 over pi m Planck over phi sub n squared is equal to 16 over n plus 1. So that, once again, the tensor-scalar ratio depends on what we pick for this number of e-folds. Okay, so there's an intrinsic uncertainty in that. If we don't understand reheating, we can't predict that with them more than, right? But for n is equal to 60, 0.26, or n is equal to 60. Which is actually, for a typical inflation model, that's pretty big. And finally, now notice that since we know epsilon, we already know the spectral index of the tensor perturbation spectrum, right? So this thing is proportional to k to the minus 2 epsilon. So the tensor scalar ratio also tells us the spectral index of the gravity wave perturbations. They're not independent. This is true for single field inflation models. We have multi-field inflation models. These two, the spectral index and the tensor scalar ratio, are independent of one another. Right, so that this relation here is only true for single field models. So the only other the only other observable parameter, we know the normalization of the density perturbation spectrum. We know the ratio of the normalizations between the density perturbations and the gravity waves. We know the spectral index for the gravity wave perturbations. We have calculated all those things. The only other observable parameter that we have left to calculate is what's the spectral index of the scalar perturbations, this little n in that other power law. And this is n is equal to 1 minus 4 epsilon at phi sub n plus 2 eta at phi sub n, where epsilon at phi m is equal to 1 over n plus 1. And eta of phi sub n, if you just plug it into that expression over there and turn the crank, is equal to 1 over 2 pi m Planck over phi sub n squared is equal to 1 over 2 times the number of e-folds plus 1. So that means that this is equal to 1 minus 3 over the number of e-folds plus 1 is about 0.95 for n is equal to 6. Yes?
Sorry, shouldn't n be 1 plus 4 epsilon minus 2 by what you have over on the top of the room?
That's because I have this wrong. Thank you. So, and this is the way you play the game. So now you have everything you need. If I give you a potential V of phi, you can just go through this little procedure that we've gone through for lambda phi 4 and calculate all the observables and compare it to the WMAP data and write lots of papers and, you know, all that stuff. Okay. But all of this basically comes from the underlying process here is this quantization of the mode in curved spacetime. Is the fundamental physical process that's allowing us to determine all the normalization. Yes?
Which one of those is excluded from lambda phi 4?
Lambda phi 4 is excluded. So if I draw, you will see that. So if I want to compare WMAP to inflation models, I imagine Joao will talk about this in more at length. is that what I want to do is actually, so you remember he was talking yesterday about how I have all these cosmological parameters, right? I have, you know, the baryon density and the cosmological constant and all that stuff. Two of the parameters that you usually put into these parameter sets are R and N, the tensor scalar ratio and the scalar spectral index. Okay? And here is N is equal to 1, and here is R of about 0.3 or so. Okay, if I actually draw the error contours for W map, I end up with something that looks like that. That's about a 2 sigma error contour for W map. So, and this is about 0.9 here. So the spectral index as determined by W map is about 0.95 plus or minus 0.02 or so. And the limit on R is R less than about 0.3. So if I take R of 0.26 and N of 0.95, I end up like a good 4 sigma off the best fit value for W map. Yeah?
So R and
N
can be different from the spectrum and from the CMB spectrum?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Because you know the power, you know the amplitude of the power spectrum, and because you have all those CLs, you can determine its slope as well.
Yeah, but here I have R as a function of the number of pixels.
Right.
So if I have R, then I can...
So if I pick N goes from 46 to 60, big N, I end up with a little line segment on this plot, and that line segment is entirely outside the W map error bar for any W. And 46 to 60. So in this case, it doesn't matter. For any choice of big N, it's still ruled out.
So for example, for the usual M squared phi squared term?
M squared phi squared lives down about there if you do the calculation. It's inside the error bar.
And what about the R? Is it also the number of e-folds?
It depends on the number of e-folds in a similar way.
It means that I can estimate the number of e-folds just from CMD data. No.
If you know what the model is, sure. But how do you know which potential you've got? Right. I mean, if somebody gave me a stone tablet with the inflaton potential on it, I could determine the number of e-folds from the power spectrum. But I don't have that information, so I can't.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Because there might be some other model. If I have a point here, that doesn't tell me the potential necessarily. There may be some other potential that for a different number of e-folds, might go like that or something like that and give me a similar thing. The question of how well I can reconstruct the inflaton potential if I know the power spectrum and a number of wavelengths is an interesting one, and there's a lot of literature on the subject. And it turns out the answer is not very well. Any more questions?
How do you get the upper limit on N equals 60? I tend to choose that figure.
Oh, inflation can go on for way more than 60 e-folds, but those scales will be redshifted outside the horizon.
Oh.
Right? So a more sophisticated way to do this, I just gave you the numerology, but is to actually calculate for a given wave number k, how many e-folds before the end of inflation did that thing exit the horizon? So if I have something the size of a quadrupole today, the question is, at what value of n did it exit the horizon and freeze? And that depends on the reheat temperature in exactly the way I showed you. But I glossed over that point for simplicity. Okay. So it's what mode exited, what was the value of big N when the mode size of the quadrupole exited the horizon? Is a more technical way to put it. Okay, thank you very much.